Well, if I may say that this is a very auspicious occasion to meet the Chief Inspector of Prisons. It's very obvious at the end of a week where the media have been treating the problems of mental illness in prison very seriously, and the end of a week when human rights have been writ very large at LSE, and the day before International Human Rights Day itself, that we have this particular opportunity to listen to Anne Oers. Many of you will know that Anne, for some 9 or 10 years, was the Director of Justice, and that was before her appointment as Chief Inspector in the year 2001. She was and has had quite a lot of experience with different government committees, including the Home Office Task Force on the implementation of human rights, as well as the Lord Chancellor's Advisory Committee on Legal Education and Conduct. In the 1980s, Anne was a very important member of staff at the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants, becoming General Secretary for more than 4 years towards the end of that. And she was also a member of the Race and Community Relations Committee of the Church of England and the board of the Centre for Research into Ethnic Relations at Warwick University. I think many of us felt that her appointment was absolutely first rate. And we've learned, many people present, a lot of the events that have occurred and some of her quite sharp, comprehensive, and very informed accounts of life in prison. And we look forward very much tonight to hearing her on rights behind bars, the conditions and treatment of those in detention. And I should have said to the audience who don't know this that I am, as chair, Peter Townsend, who has had something to do with the confirmation of the Centre for Human Rights in LSE, and how glad I am for helping to do that, and how much human rights are flourishing, as they should, at this day and age in LSE. But Anne.
Thank you very much, Peter, for those kind words. And thank you for inviting me to give a lecture on nearly Human Rights Day. I think we can sort of extend it by a few hours here and there. I need to start off what I'm going to say really with a couple of disclaimers, one of which I always give in audiences like this. I've spent the last 3.5 years in and around prisons and not courts, and listening to prisoners and prison staff, not to lawyers and academic argument. So this won't be in any sense an erudite lecture on the state of human rights law, domestic or international, in relation to prisons. I also have to apologise to anyone who's heard me say some of the things I'm going to say tonight before. There are only a limited number of things you can say about prisons. They sadly remain much as they were a year ago, 2 years ago, and so some of you may have heard me say some of these things before. I want to do two things in the course of the next 45 minutes or so. The first is to set out some of the human rights issues and dilemmas which I've observed in 3.5 years of inspecting prisons in England and Wales, some of which have come before the courts here or in Strasbourg. And the second is to consider why the independent inspection of prisons is a necessary part of human rights compliance and what form it should take. And within that, to raise some questions about current plans for restructuring public service inspectorates. The importance of protecting human rights in a closed institution, such as a prison, is of course well established in the various human rights instruments and bodies that exist to provide the necessary safeguards for those detained by the state. It's also accepted by our own government. Jack Straw, when he was Home Secretary, prefaced the International Centre for Prison Studies handbook, A Human Rights Approach to Prison Management, by saying, "I strongly believe that the way societies treat those who've been deprived of their liberty is a litmus test of commitment to human rights." And this government was among the first to ratify the new protocol to the UN Convention on Inhuman Treatment and Torture, with its undertaking that there should be independent inspection of all places of detention. It's also well known that we have around 75,000 people in our prisons, more per capita than any other Western European country. There is, in fact, considerable relief that that figure isn't higher. Earlier this year, it was suggested that the number might top 80,000 by this time, of those in custody. And I say in custody because there's no way our prisons could have accommodated them, let alone accommodated them safely. They would have been decanted into any available space, police cells, army camps, whatever. This levelling off of numbers from what was expected is, as I said, a relief. But it's not, as sometimes implied now, a matter for complacency. There are notionally just over 77,000 spaces in our prisons. But the notion of space is based upon the prisons being 24% overcrowded and without any headroom. We have built overcrowding into the system just as surely as we've built in suicides, self-harm, and mental illness. And indeed, the four are closely connected. And one of the themes of this lecture is the way in which prisons, things that would be unacceptable in any other context can become accepted and even built into the system. Overcrowded prisons are places where two prisoners routinely share a cell meant for one, sometimes in the presence of an unscreened toilet. They may spend 23 hours a day there. Living in a lavatory in any other public building would contravene any number of public health and decency standards, but it's accepted in our prisons. Alternatively, prisoners may lack in-cell sanitation at all and be dependent on a call bell system, where a combination of unreliable systems, less than assiduous staff, security considerations and over-demand can mean that actually they have to slop out, or as we showed recently in Portland, young offenders' institution slop out of the window. And sometimes in women's prisons when they're pregnant or menstruating. Or else prisoners may be held in a ship, the weir, which is essentially a container, with no access to any useful training or activity, without natural air and light except for 1 hour's exercise a day. The prison service doesn't want to hold prisoners in those conditions, but it has no headroom or resources to close down or reconfigure those establishments, as this would reduce the number of prison places. Overcrowded prisons are nevertheless places which have experienced a sea change in attitude, culture, and activity over the last 10 years. Nothing that I'm going to say should obscure the fact that in our prisons there are more people being taught basic literacy and numeracy, being treated and detoxed for substance use problems, being offered mental health support than in any other public institution. Additional resources have been made available, external specialists have been recruited, and standards of professional service are starting to align with those outside. Prison healthcare, for example, has benefited hugely from being absorbed into the NHS. I believe that inspection has played a key role in stimulating those changes, pointing to deficiencies in individual prisons and doing thematic reviews that point to the need for systemic change. But I also believe that the current population pressure, even in its present less acute form, creates a huge undertow, pulling against the kind of positive change we could see and need to see. That undertow is not just because of the number, but also the kind of people we hold in our prisons. Another area where we've seen real change is the culture within prisons. These days, it's rare to inspect a prison where staff attitudes and behaviour are positively inimical to the dignity and positive development of those they hold, though it does happen. The focus on decency in prisons, the fact that the prison service's own procedures now try to measure the quality of life and relationships, have had an effect. However, it's more common to find prisons where staff and prisoners together experience daily the effects of chronic, unremitting pressure, where the strategy is to cope in circumstances that inhibit the ability to deliver safe and positive environments. Prisons are good at coping, at dealing with what comes through the door. They have to be. Unlike other institutions, such as mental health facilities, they cannot refuse to accept anyone sent to them unless they literally have no space, however unsuitable a placement prison is. They have, thank goodness, grown better at preventing riots and escapes. But those effective coping strategies can obscure the nature and the extent of the problems staff and prisoners face behind closed doors. As I've said, I don't want in any way to underplay the valuable work done, that goes on in prisons and the committed staff that do it with some of the most difficult and damaged people in our society. But I do want to focus on the human rights issues that daily confront people in prisons. And those issues have surfaced in court judgments both here and Strasbourg. My argument will be that those judgments are the tip of an iceberg. Every day, governors in our prisons and staff are at the sharp end of human rights compliance. And in a few cases, they will be presiding over human rights violations they are powerless to prevent or are unaware of. Let me begin at the sharpest end, the duty of care, the duty to preserve life. The rate of all deaths in custody is increasing, but the rate of self-inflicted deaths is now settling at around 2 a week. Self-inflicted deaths have become part of the currency of penal life. In a recent week where there were 6 of them, they were not even reported. Most of those who kill themselves in our prisons are among the most vulnerable of prisoners. New to custody, sometimes not even sentenced, often detoxifying from drugs, mentally ill, in prison health care or segregation. The prison service has undoubtedly made considerable efforts to prevent and reduce suicide and self-harm, spurred on in part by an inspectorate thematic report. There are systems, procedures and guidance for managing those at risk, and the pattern of self-injury is now monitored. Part of the role of an inspectorate is to check that those procedures are applied rigorously, but our role is also to point to the underlying causes of the epidemic of suicide and self-harm, the vulnerability of those entering prison, and the additional vulnerability that results from their incarceration. And we bring a multidisciplinary approach to this that involves social work and counselling skills, healthcare skills. Recent studies have shown that suicides in prison don't necessarily correlate with vigilance in carrying out protective procedures. Organisations are good at process, at designing procedures. But suicide prevention is about something much more subtle and important. Suicide rates correlate very strongly with prisoners' feelings of distress, and those feelings themselves correlate with feelings of whether they're safe or not, which in turn depend upon respectful and right relationships with other prisoners, with staff, with their families outside. So that the human dignity that is at the heart of human rights compliance is also at the heart of suicide prevention. Inspections can capture that quality of life better than standards and targets by surveying prisoners, talking to them, observing what's going on, talking with staff, confidential surveys, all of those kind of things. They can detect the difference between two prisons, similar in function, resources and population, where one's perceptibly safe and decent, the other edgy, unkempt, and with a drug subculture. But there are important protective measures that prisons must take in respect to their duty of care. Prisoners are particularly vulnerable in the early days in custody, not least because many are withdrawing from drugs. In the case of Judith McGlinchey in 2003, the European Court of Human Rights found a breach of Article 3 in relation to her death under a poorly managed detoxification scheme. The previous year, my inspectors had reported on Stile Women's Prison, where we found women fitting and vomiting in their cells for want of adequate detoxification and called for urgent action. 18 months later, a proper detoxification regime was put in place, too late for the 6 women who died in the intervening period, all in the early days of custody, all having had a serious drug habit. And the absence of proper detox at Stile was not for want of knowing what to do. The women's policy group in the prison service had developed effective treatment for drug withdrawal specific to the needs of women. But no one ensured that it was put in place as a matter of urgency in a prison where 70% of women were withdrawing from drugs. It was not because staff didn't care, they did, but they were engaged in crisis management in a prison that was barely coping with the scale of demand it faced, engaged in firefighting rather than planned prevention. It's welcome that there have been no deaths in Stiles so far since proper detoxification was put in place, and that detox generally in the women's estate has improved considerably. That's undoubtedly been spurred on and resources levered out of the system because of the combined pressure of case law, inquiries and inspection. Women prisoners have much higher suicide rates than men inside prison. They don't outside prison, but they do inside. Sheena Creamer's case came before the House of Lords earlier this year, one of 2 cases that led to a judgment that coroners could and should comment on the circumstances as well as the cause of death. Sheena Creamer was typical of women who die in prison, not yet sentenced, worried about her home and family, recently withdrawing from heroin. The new inquest will look in detail at the circumstances that led to her death. But let me also put it in the context of New Hall, the prison where she died, which we inspected last year. It's a prison where we found that each month 75 suicide risk forms were being opened, 129 self-harm incidents recorded, 43 involving ligatures, which require immediate action if death's to be avoided, where every patient in the prison hospital was severely mentally ill, and when insufficient beds were available, were likely to be held in the segregation unit. Newhall holds girls and young women under 21. 14 of those were on suicide watch. 3 17-year-olds were self-harming daily. Though there'd been 4 self-inflicted deaths in the previous 18 months, prison staff had saved many more lives, and indeed did so while we were there. A raft of new processes and procedures for investigating deaths in custody is now being put in place, inspired by the Article 2 obligations now imported into English law. Middleton and Creamer have established coroner's duty to inquire into the circumstances of death, hopefully in the context of a complete review of coronial powers and procedures. And inquests increasingly are recording verdicts of systemic failure, most recently the death of a young woman called Annie Kelly in Northern Ireland. The Prison and Probation Ombudsman is now charged with investigating all deaths in custody in probation hostels. That will be an onerous task. Since the 1st of April, when he took the job on, there have been 169 deaths, including deaths by natural causes and assault, as well as self-inflicted deaths. Mounting speedy investigations, producing swift conclusions to try to prevent recurrence will be a challenge. But these inquiries are only part of the picture. Inevitably, they start from the inability of the state to keep alive someone in its care. In our view, inquiries should also follow near-death incidents, both because the Article 2 arguments are equally strong and because the reasons and circumstances can better be established and preventive measures taken. I spoke earlier of population pressure and shared cells. This has implications for prisoners' safety as well as their dignity. Those shared cells are inhabited by a transitory population, often arriving late and in numbers from court or being moved around from prison to prison to make space for the next arrivals. At one time, when pressure was at its highest, prisons and the prison service were effectively playing musical cells, trying to find a space. The pressure is still there, even if it has reduced somewhat. The cases of Christopher Edwards and Zahid Mubarak vividly show the risks inherent in cell sharing with others who may be violent or psychotic. Prisons need to carry out rigorous risk assessments before making those decisions. A few still don't or do so scantily, and we point that out when we inspect. But let's consider what prisons have to do. A prisoner arrives, perhaps with 30 or 40 others, in the late afternoon or early evening, in many cases still withdrawing from drugs. Leeds Prison, when we inspected it last year, had settled in 438 new prisoners in a month. Each prisoner may carry with them only a court warrant, in some cases indeed only an interim warrant, bearing the informative information, nature of offence, crime. In a short interview in a crowded reception area before locking prisoners down for the night, staff must establish, largely from the prisoner, him or herself, and from their own observations and experience, whether prisoners pose a risk to others or to themselves. And then, juggling the few available places, try to place each one safely, either alone or with a suitable cellmate. Arriving at a new prison is a time of maximum vulnerability for prisoners. Yet prison staff aren't helped by the fact that getting prisoners to prison at a reasonable time does not have the same priority for escort contractors or indeed for the courts themselves as getting them to court on time. Governors can face contempt proceedings for the latter. There are no penalties for the former, such as the mentally ill young man I saw with a history of self-harm and a recent bereavement who was sent to prison for a mental health assessment by a judge at 10:40 a.m. and did not reach the young offender institution until 8:30 p.m. As often happens, prison reception staff stayed well behind the end of their shift, but they were unable to deal with his considerable problems fully at that time. In my last annual report, I raised the issue of mental health in prisons, something that's been developed by Nick Davis in his recent Guardian articles this week. Many of you will be aware of the first European Court of Human Rights finding of an Article 3 violation in relation to prison conditions against the UK in the case of Keenan. Mark Keenan was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and personality disorder. He spent his time in prison being shuffled between the healthcare centre, where he attacked staff, and the segregation unit, where he eventually killed himself. In the last 3.5 years, I've seen many Mark Keenans still alive. In some cases, they're waiting transfer to an NHS secure facility. This, though quicker than it used to be, still takes up to 3 months, during which time significant deterioration can occur, in an environment that, despite the best efforts of staff, is not essentially therapeutic and cannot treat severe mental illness without the patient's consent. When asked how long he thought a prisoner in this condition should wait before transfer, the head of prison healthcare at a recent conference said if it were a relative of mine, no more than a day or two. Others, however, have been returned from secure facilities as too disruptive to manage, like a young man of 18 who was in a body belt for 3 days because without it he tore strips off his allegedly tear-proof clothing and tried to hang himself. If given a television, he broke the glass and ate it. Thanks to considerable and commendable efforts by the prison service, he was resectioned and readmitted to a secure NHS hospital. When I inspected one women's prison recently, the healthcare centre had a row of stools outside three of the cells. Outside each sat an agency nurse, literally watching the prisoner at all times. Inside each was a mentally ill young woman, including one who came to the door begging to be let out because her voices were tormenting her and who'd already tied 9 ligatures that morning. Daily in our prisons, governors and staff are trying to keep those prisoners safe, while also respecting their human dignity and the safety of other prisoners and staff. And daily their vulnerability is increased by imprisonment, like the girl in one prison with Asperger's syndrome, held in a healthcare centre that mainly contained mentally ill and severely self-harming adult women. And it was a feature of her condition that she mimicked the behaviour around her. Other Mark Keenans are no longer alive. 1 in 5 of those who kill themselves in prison do so in segregation units or hospitals. And it's a fair bet that most are mentally ill. Indeed, in some prisons we visit, it's impossible to get a bed in a prison hospital if you're only physically ill. The prison service's strategies for coping are often less than ideal, born out of desperation rather than care planning. Like Mark Keenan, many prisoners are shuffled between healthcare and segregation to offer respite for staff, or from prison to prison in a policy known as sale or return, where governors pass the parcel of their most difficult and disruptive prisoners. One young man who killed himself in prison had been in 30 prisons in 18 months. These are extreme cases, as are all potential human rights violations, but they are the tip of an iceberg of chronic mental instability and depression. Some statistics put it as high as 3/4 of the prison population. I described it in one report as the quiet despair of those who are not so acutely ill that they demand constant attention. It's undoubtedly the case that mental health provision in prisons has improved and is set to improve still further. Under the new commissioning arrangements with Primary Care Trust, prisons now have mental health in-reach teams. Some have daycare centres. But those teams are still firefighting. In most cases, they can only deal with those whose mental health problems are both severe and enduring, rather than chronic and sporadic. It's important to chronicle and re-inspect the treatment and conditions for those prisoners and to uphold their human rights. But we also have to ask deeper questions, principally whether prison is the right place or can ever provide the right environment, especially in overcrowded prisons, where prisoners, particularly the difficult ones, are liable to be locked up most of the day. Let us be in no doubt. We are using our prisons as society's too difficult tray, in which to contain, and it's little more than that in many cases, usually for short but repeated periods, those for whom there's no proper provision outside prison or who've already been excluded from society. They include the mentally ill, as well as young people who've been in care, excluded or truanted from school, those addicted to drugs and alcohol. And we're asking prisons to do this on the cheap. In a local male prison where many of those prisoners are to be found, the average cost of a prisoner place is £30,000 a year. A bed in a regional secure NHS facility costs £136,000. For women in local prisons, the relative costs are £36,000 and £163,000. Those differences are a precise measure of the difference in the number of skilled staff available to treat and work with the patient. I could have focused this part of the lecture entirely on the conditions of treatment of children in prison, for whom we have a specialist team. There I would have made similar points. The children who end up in our prisons are the most difficult and damaged in society. They're cared for by staff who are not specifically trained in the care of disturbed adolescents, at a fraction of the cost of a local authority's secure home and outside the direct scope of the Children Act. Resources and facilities for them have considerably improved, but our inspections continue to raise concerns about some of the very vulnerable young people held in prisons. Mr. Justice Munby's decisions in the Howard League and CF cases have helped greatly in clarifying both the fact that the children themselves are within the scope of the Act and that local authorities, in particular area child protection committees, can't divest themselves of their responsibilities for safeguarding those children simply because they're incarcerated. Courts and their ability to act on human rights abuses are a key part of human rights protection. But those in prison may not find it easy to access courts. Many will be there for only a short time on each occasion, though their total length of stay in prison may be years. Others will be incapable or unable to access legal help, at least until it's too late. For that reason, international human rights law also demands that there should be independent monitoring of places of detention. Indeed, in recent cases, some of our findings have been able to assist the courts to put into context the individual case in front of them. Incarceration is in this country the severest penalty the state can exact, and therefore requires the most robust scrutiny. By definition, prisons are hidden from public view. As I've already made clear, they face some difficult human rights dilemmas, looking after people that society has given up on or doesn't want to deal with. But there are also places that can and do easily become self-referential, lacking the external checks and balances that make institutions ask difficult questions rather than revert to a default setting of convenience. At their very worst, they can degrade those they hold. The pictures from Abu Ghraib are a potent reminder of what unchecked custodial power can do. There are others. In the mid-19th century, English local prisons were transformed into agents of carefully graded punishment by Edward Duquesne, using the treadmill and the crank, so that one judge considered a 2-year sentence in such a jail to be, quote, next only to death, unquote, in severity of sentence. Sean McConville, in his book of that name, reminds us, and I'm quoting, if we define power as the enforcement of will, irrespective of the wishes of the person upon whom it's enforced, the system of local imprisonment developed in England from the 1860s onwards was above all an exercise in power. Cut loose from the restraints of community and traditional ethical moorings, it came close to a confusion of means with ends, and a belief that any means was justified short of permanent disablement, death, or the personal caprice or advantage of the captor. It had but one intent, to suppress resistance, and to ensure that whatever was going on in the mind of the offender, he would submit or be broken. That is, thank goodness, light years away from anything I have observed in any of the custodial settings I have inspected. But it indicates the power and the isolation within a closed environment. And there have been abuses in our prisons within recent years. Prisons can go bad very quickly. The balance of power is always with the custodian, not the detainee. Prisons inspecting is an essential part of those ethical and community moorings that McConville found lacking in the late 19th century. Indeed, as he points out, the development of a harsh and essentially punitive system was paralleled by the emasculation of the powers of prison inspectors, some of whom had previously been robust critics of slopping out and the use of degrading work, but who became subsumed into the work of the prison commissioners who ran the prisons. And at the same time, the powers of local justices, community watchdogs, and forerunners of present independent monitoring boards were also curtailed. I've said on other occasions that I've rarely been into a prison where inspection didn't reveal something that those running it didn't know or had ignored. I've described what I call the virtual prison, the one that exists in the governor's office, at prison service headquarters, or in the minister's red boxes, as compared with the actual prison being operated on the ground. Inspections pick up that inspection gap between what ought to be and what is. Some of those seem minor in comparison with the extreme issues I raised earlier, but they're all important to the human dignity of those held in custody. Let me give you some examples. Adjudications, the process by which offences against prison discipline are judged and punished. Punishments can include cellular confinement and segregation, sometimes without access to any external simulation except a Bible, loss of meagre prison earnings, so no tobacco, no additional food, loss of association, and therefore loss of access to phones and contact with families as well as other prisoners. There's no independent judge, no defence lawyer to hold the ring. In one prison we inspected recently, we observed adjudications where a prisoner was cautioned without being found guilty, where a complete defence was ignored, where no mitigation was sought, and where the only word on the adjudication sheet was guilty. In another prison, a woman who tried to commit suicide was adjudicated on and punished for refusing to go into strip conditions, a practice that in itself is contrary to guidance issued by the prison service. These are practices which can flourish unchecked, not because of any willful desire to abuse, but simply because they become customary, and they're simple. In some prisons, we found staff routinely reading all prisoners' personal correspondence, in one case because they thought it was very helpful to know what was happening in prisoners' personal lives. In spite of ECHR rulings establishing prisoners' right to privacy and subsequent prison instructions that only a small proportion of prisoners' mail may randomly be read, except for those who pose specific risks. Prison inspections are important for the small as well as the large things. For example, I'm reminded of one young offender institution we inspected recently, which provided 18 to 21-year-old young men with a cold breakfast pack the night before, which unsurprisingly was eaten before bedtime, and then only provided them with a baguette the following lunchtime, with no substantial meal until the evening. Or, for example, a segregation unit in which all prisoners mysteriously had to take off their shoes and put them outside the door, not to be cleaned, I add, but just because that was what they did there. We're now regularly inspecting immigration removal centres, where those who aren't charged or convicted of any criminal offence are held under administrative powers indefinitely. Their detention is rightly subject to particularly high scrutiny. We found centres where detainees held in separation units, whether for disciplinary or protective reasons, were routinely strip-searched and held in strip conditions without any assessment of risk. We've expressed particular concern about the detention of children, which we say should be exceptional and for no more than a matter of days. Yet when we inspected Oakington Immigration Centre, we found that there was no evidence of the minimum safeguards that should be in place to detain children. The decisions are made at a senior level with regard to Article 8 of the European Convention of Human Rights. Indeed, officials appeared to be unaware that those procedures existed. We don't routinely inspect court cells or prisoner escorts. When we did, in the course of an area criminal justice inspection, we found in one court conditions that wouldn't be tolerated within a prison. No certification of the maximum number of prisoners that could be held in each cell, ineffective alarm bells and evacuation procedures, no child protection measures or risk assessments for carrying men, women and children in a single van. In another court recently, we found prisoners in wooden partitioned cells 33 inches wide. That's about 90 centimetres in new money. Those cells are now out of use. Finally, we were recently asked to independently inspect the Military Corrective and Training Centre at Colchester, having already assisted the armed forces to develop procedures to manage detainees at risk of suicide. Given recent concerns about army facilities, both here and overseas, this is both welcome and, I'd say, necessary. We didn't unearth any scandals, but we did find two things. We found a failure to understand and implement the army's own policies on diversity, and we found a complaints procedure that was far from meeting international norms or providing the necessary safeguards for detainees who might be at risk or vulnerable. That procedure consisted of marching all the detainees onto the parade ground with the company sergeant major calling them to attention. Anyone with a complaint was then invited to step out and was marched to a room where they could speak to the army visiting officer, an officer from the nearby garrison. We were told it was confidential because nobody knew what the complaint was, but it was a pretty terrifying procedure to have to go through. Those, I think, are examples of the way in which genuinely independent inspection lifts the lid on closed institutions on behalf of the public. It pulls out common practices and exposes them to the light of what's normal and what's right. It's a very important protective and preventive measure. It's also an important driver for change. It points out good practice as well as bad. It gives ammunition to those running prisons and supporting prisoners to press for resources, support, and change. But independent inspection of the kind I've described can also be uncomfortable for prisons, the prison service, officials and government. At present, there's pressure to streamline and join up public services and the structures that inspect them. The gains to be made are clear, making services more efficient and accountable, reducing duplication, filling in gaps in provision. But there's always a danger in simplifying and amalgamating that legitimately different aims and objectives are elided and confused, that we end up with what I've called a primeval soup rather than clearly focused processes and objectives. We use the word inspection to describe a variety of different functions: regulation, performance management, independent evaluation of whether public bodies are meeting standards and providing value for money. But the kind of inspection I have been describing is different. It is, as I said earlier, part of the system's ethical and community moorings. It's no accident that we don't inspect the prison service. We inspect the conditions in prisons and the treatment of prisoners. We examine the treatment of the prisoner as a whole person, not just an offender. We also examine the whole environment of the prison, the healthcare, relationships, safety, education. And we do so in detail, establishment by establishment. There is a critical difference between inspection activity that examines the efficiency of a system and that which provides a detailed, holistic account of each individual custodial environment. And finally, our work ranges beyond criminal justice, as I've said, to encompass other custodial settings, reaching into those agencies and services also that provide health, education, employment and housing, for those in and after custody. I've set out four principles that have to underpin this kind of inspection and that are a critical part of human rights compliance. One is that the scale and focus of inspection of individual places of custody is central, as I've just said. Of course, the relationship of prisons to the rest of criminal justice is important, but that needs to be in addition to, not instead of, continued attention to what goes on behind a prison's walls. Secondly, it's important that a chief inspector has, as I have, the ability, the flexibility, and the resources on my sole authority to go into any prison at any time without warning. That is a critical human rights safeguard. Indeed, it's a kind of virtual inspection, because every governor in the country knows that at any time an inspection team can knock on the gate, demand entry, draw keys, and have unfettered access to all prisoners, staff, and documents. And we do. My first unannounced inspection of that kind was at Dartmoor, and that was a fairly terrifying experience. I hope it was as terrifying for the prison as it was for me at the time. Thirdly, we need to report directly to ministers and the public, not mediating it through officials or any other structure. It's entirely understandable that services, departments, and governments want to co-opt inspectors to help them in the task of improving performance and effectiveness. All inspections about making things better, and it requires dialogue and cooperation with those running services and those responsible for them. But a human rights-based inspectorate, in the end, always needs to be able, if necessary, to stand outside government, to speak truth to power. Fourthly, and consequentially, the final cornerstone of what we do is that we have our own methodology and criteria for inspecting custodial environments, which are independent of the standards and the targets of those services. Those criteria are grounded in ethical principles as set out in international human rights standards. We define what we call a healthy prison by reference to four tests, first set out by the World Health Organization, where the prisoners are held in safety, treated with respect for their human dignity, offered purposeful activity, and prepared for resettlement into the community. Our detailed criteria, which we call expectations, are based not upon minimum auditable standards, but upon best practice. They don't examine whether targets are met. Targets often measure what's measurable, not what's important. They test quality, not compliance. They may, as the earlier part of my talk has shown, point to a systemic failure that stretches across and even beyond the prison service. They don't, as such, look at value for money. What price is suicide? Though they may well reveal that resources are wasted or staff or managers insufficiently active. This hasn't been achieved without a struggle. Both my predecessor and I were under some pressure to accept and monitor the standards of the prison service itself. Indeed, Sir David Ramsbottom was initially told he couldn't publish expectations. But it's a measure of the robustness of our criteria and the credibility of the inspectorate that I've now been able to reissue them without challenge, referenced against international human rights standards, and 96 of them derived directly from those standards. Furthermore, we've been able to adapt those criteria and that methodology to inspect other custodial settings, such as immigration removal centres and the military corrective centre. Indeed, our expectations have now been exported to other countries. They've been welcomed by the Foreign Office's Human Rights Department, and I've shared them with the many delegations from places like Russia and China and elsewhere who come to my office to ask about best practice in safeguarding conditions and treatment in prisons. Those pillars of independent prisons inspection have been guaranteed by ministers in Parliament and in correspondence. They're just as important in the new landscape that's now being set out by what's called the National Offender Management Service, that service which will now manage both prison and probation services. There are many good things about that service, focusing on the offender, not the service, the need to join up what happens in prison with what happens outside, the need to reduce the prison population if prisons are to be effective. But the norms framework is also based on a word called contestability, envisaging an increased involvement by the private sector and contracted-in providers. It is, if anything, more important that there should be an independent inspectorate able to stand outside the contracts that are negotiated with private providers and the process by which they're determined, as it is for independence from the standards a public sector service imposes on itself. My first inspection of Ashfield, a privately contracted young offenders institution, was the most depressing report I'd then issued, and described an establishment that was failing by some margin to provide a safe and decent environment for children. A principal reason, as I said in the report, was that it had become, quote, an island, isolated from developments and expectations in the rest of the juvenile custodial system, and it was an island whose contours appeared to be the precise terms of the contract, rather than any wider understanding of the needs of children. It's to the credit of Ashfield's managers and contractors that within a short time it was turned into one of the better children's prisons. But it's a warning shot across the bows of those who believe that privatisation and contract compliance of themselves always drive up performance. So the need for human rights-based inspection and human rights needs of those in prisons will remain, if anything, more important in the NOMS era. But independence in all these circumstances is a fragile construct. Of course it's important it's set out in statute, chief inspector responsible directly to the minister, duty to report as you find, and so on. The statute that governs my office actually says very little other than that I'm to inspect the conditions and treatment of those in prison. But the statutory provision isn't enough. Before I was chief inspector, a delegation of Russians came to discuss prisons and prison policy when Sir David Ramsbottom was chief inspector. They asked about the Inspectorate of Prisons. Who appoints the chief inspector, they asked. The Home Secretary was the answer. And where's the chief inspector's office? In the Home Office, was the answer. And who is the chief inspector? A retired general. Ah, they said in understanding tones, we have independent inspectorates like that. It is those skirmishes around the edge of the territory, like the battle for our own standards and criteria, that define the contours of independence. As in the 19th century, inspectors have constantly been on the watch against becoming part of the system they inspect, however seductively that's presented by those who are part of it and may indeed genuinely wish to improve it. There are, as I said, moves to restructure inspectorates. And inspectorates surely can't object to being scrutinised and potentially reformed and changed, since that's what we demand of others. In relation to prisons, this has possibly involved a merger with the probation inspectorate, mirroring the National Offender Management Service. And this could focus on the individual prisoner, where a human rights dimension could sit alongside and be of equal importance to inspecting the management of offenders through the system. Alternatively, though, there's talk of a wider merger into a single criminal justice inspectorate, capable of looking across the whole criminal justice system, identifying gaps, encouraging joint working and effective process, promoting the overall aims of crime reduction and community safety. This is more troubling. It's difficult to see how a human rights-based inspectorate can be other than peripheral to a body whose main aims are the effectiveness of criminal justice and the reduction of crime. They're laudable aims, but they're different, and they require a different approach, methodology, and focus. So there are some crucial questions I shall be asking over the next few months if there is a possibility of prisons inspecting being absorbed into a larger whole. First, how will the key principles I've outlined be guaranteed, not just in statute, but in practice and over time? Secondly, how can a human rights focus be preserved and nurtured within an organisation in which it's peripheral or instrumental to a broader aim? And thirdly, how is the direct connection between prisons inspecting and the public, parliament and ministers to be preserved? I remain concerned that over time, and perhaps inadvertently, the sharp focus and robustly independent voice of the prisons inspectorate may be lost. One answer to the Russians' question may be that it doesn't matter what the background is of the person you appoint. If you give them a remit to report independently and freely on the conditions in our overcrowded prisons, you leave them and their inspection teams no choice but to be robust, focused, and at times awkward. The same is true, of course, of those who take cases on behalf of prisoners. But once that task is part of a broader aim, however necessary and laudable, there's a risk of blurring the process and changing the nature of the task and the way it's carried out. From what I've said, it's evident that our prisons do face considerable human rights challenges as we speak, and they will continue to do so. There's no immediate possibility of those pressures being removed or of those people, a different kind of people, being in our prisons or those in them being taken out. While that remains the case, it underlines the need for independent inspection of prisons, for vigilance on those running prisons, both from the courts, from independent inquiries, and from inspectorates. They're all part of an essential framework of trying to protect the human rights of those that we imprison. We are all, and inspectorates where I sit, I have a particular interest in, we're all an essential part of the protection of human rights of those held in detention. And that all of those, including inspection, are too valuable to lose or to diminish. Thank you.
Gosh.
That was a comprehensive but very disturbing analysis. And I'm sure people will want to follow up with questions quite sharply. We do have quite a good period of time before we break round about 7:30. There will be refreshments, drinks in nearby, and I will tell you where at just before 7:30. That, I hope, will hold a few of you just that little bit longer from departing too quickly. But in all seriousness, we've had perhaps in some senses a pessimistic analysis, and yet it also carries with it a kind of tribute to the best that can exist in public service, which in various capacities a lot of people in this audience are trying to uphold. I have many questions, but the floor is now open, and I will receive any questions or comments. Please. Yes. Sorry, speak up a bit more. I can't even hear you.
Did you miss the whole of the question?
No, I didn't.
Okay, and what measures are going to be put into place to make that process more accountable, more transparent, so that people can get a better idea of what's going on in these centres?
Let's take it one by one.
Okay. Yes, what I meant was that they need the highest scrutiny. What I didn't mean was that they always get it. What I was meaning is that when we inspect those centres, we look with particular care and attention at them, simply because they hold people who've not been before court and who've not been charged or convicted of any crime. So that for us it is very important that at least our inspections provide some kind of transparency, some kind of information coming out of those centres, and that we have developed, as we have with prisons, our own set of expectations and criteria that we hold them up against. But you're right. I mean, the processes by which people get there and what happens to them once they're there, all custodial environments, are out of the public gaze.
Perhaps we could take questions in groups, two or three at a time. Please.
I found your talk remarkable in the sense that you're addressing a population which is very vulnerable, but as well which is morally condemned by the rest of the population. So that you speak out in their favor, that you help them, you hold them as being entitled to human rights as much as anyone else, I think is very remarkable. I have a series of questions, and I'm very ignorant about England, Britain. I'm not English myself, so maybe it's just out of ignorance I'm asking questions. The first one is, to yourself as the chief inspector, what do you think should be the function of prisons? And I think to answer that question, what should answer a different set of questions as well. What are the causes of prisoners ending up in prisons? And I'm thinking about a book by James Gilligan on violence in prisons in the US, which when I read it was very revealing, and I found it came as a shock to me. So I share Gilligan's analysis, but I'd like to know what's your opinion on that. And also I'd like maybe to have a comment on what's the perception of the public, English public, the British public, sorry, of what prisoners are. Because Gilligan makes this, he says this, prisoners are put into a category, and being categorized as bad people, insane people, then you don't have to deal with them anymore. They are not part of ourselves. They are, you know, you can put them into jail, and thereby it's possible to violate the human rights. And I was wondering, so what's the perception of the British public, and also what's the perception of the caretakers? How do they relate, and how do they judge their own prisoners? And did you see any, there's Human Rights Watch report on rapes in prison in the US. Do you think that exists? something that you might not have discovered, but I mean that seems kind of possible. Thank you.
I think that's a group of questions in itself. And I personally, when answering questions, like I can cope with three or four at a time, and I think it's proper that we should ask Anne to respond to one or two of those.
Right, it's a whole lot. You could have an entire lecture actually based on answer to those questions. They're all very interesting. What do you want prison to do? I think one of the things when you try to engage with the public about prisons, you have to ask the question: what do you want to happen as a result of someone being in prison? And of course, people's first reaction to that is that they want someone to be punished. Prisons are places of punishment. It's of course quite clear in all the legal frameworks and all the ethical frameworks that prison is a place of punishment, not a place for punishment. Better people are punished. But punishment is the first thing that people come up with. But when you ask a little more carefully about what they want, as with all crime, is they want people not to do it again. And most of the people in our prisons are going to be there for a very short time. The great majority are there for less than a year. So they're going to be out again quite soon. And we need prisons to be places which deal with the underlying causes and why they're there in the first place. Whether there's underlying causes of drug dependence, alcohol dependence, mental illness, whatever they are, we need lack of education. 70% of people coming into prisons lack basic literacy and numeracy. We need prisons to be places which can actually deal with those issues and problems, rather than just churn people out through a revolving door so they come back again. So I think that there is a community of interest that you can get to, even though the initial reaction may not be a good one. But when people actually meet prisoners and people who've been in prisons, their reactions change quite dramatically, except, of course, for those very serious offenders. But that they are, in the main, people who have chaotic and dysfunctional lives and who need something to happen to change those lives around. And so there's a difference when people actually meet them. You asked about rape. I genuinely think it is not the issue in English prisons as it is in US prisons, partly because we run our prisons rather differently. One of the reasons I think that is because, as part of our prisons inspecting, we do a confidential survey of a statistically significant proportion of the prisoners in that prison. And that survey doesn't pass through anyone's hands but our own. And it invites prisoners to tell us about everything that's happened to them. We ask a series of questions: what happened, how were they treated in reception, how they were treated by escort vans, what happened to them going through the system. And we ask about whether they have been hit or abused by an officer, whether they have been hit or abused by a prisoner, whether they have been sexually assaulted, whether they have been racially abused. And we get positives to quite a lot of those, but we get very, very few positives to and that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. I'm not naive enough to assume that it never happens. But I think we're not picking up through those surveys anything like the scale of the abuse that we know happens in US jails.
Thank you. Yes. Yes, you.
You mentioned Nick Davis in The Guardian, which I thought provided a very bleak outlook of the condition of the mentally ill in prison. And beyond the demonstration as to the shortage of resources for those people who actually may well be better off in hospital beds, one of the most depressing things I found was the bureaucratic battle that appears to take place between the prison, who are obliged to take any prisoner that the psychiatric hospitals refuse, and the psychiatric hospitals themselves, and have to deal with somebody who is very difficult. What I wonder is if there's any scope to compel psychiatric hospitals indeed to take on those prisoners who are in fact quite difficult to deal with.
That's very clear. Let's have a couple more. Connor.
Thanks. Connor Geertie, the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. I think it's a shocking narrative, and what I want to ask you to consider is why we've got to this situation, and if it's overcrowding, which a lot of people say is a big part of it, why there are so many people in jail. Is it the case there's been an increase in crime? Is it the case that we've closed our asylums and there's a lot of people on the street who would previously be behind different walls? Is it, as a lot of people say, a kind of new brutal culture which concentrates on the punitive and doesn't think about the rehabilitation? And if it's that, who drives it? Is it government? Is it a few newspapers? So if overcrowding is one of the big bases for the whole thing, why are there so many people in jail? Courts, politicians, newspapers?
One more before I announce. Yes.
Kim Edgar, Prison Reform Trust. Hi. One of the health inspectors estimated there were 500 people in the healthcare centers who were serious enough that they needed immediate transfer, and that was a few years ago. Nick Davis estimated it, because of course that's just the healthcare centers, estimated the number in the prison service as a whole is about 3,700 to 4,000 people in need of immediate transfer to medical, to NHS facilities, and makes the point there are only 4,000 beds. My concern from PRT is, coming around to the question, just the chance that they would be transferred from a situation in which there has been a lot of work to defend their human rights into an environment where their human rights would be even more at risk. I don't know if you see what I mean. Thanks.
Yes, do go ahead, yeah. Please.
I could take the two mental health ones together. Kimita, I assume that what you're meaning is that there may not be such vigilance about their human rights in a secure NHS unit as there is in prison. It's not. I agree that it's not an easy and immediate choice. I mean, the answer to the question over there is that at the moment, it's not possible to compel any psychiatric institution, unit, hospital to take anyone. They can refuse because they are not treatable. Because if a psychiatrist diagnoses that you are suffering from a personality disorder and not a psychiatric illness. And therefore you can't be treated, therefore you can't go into hospital. Or because you're too disruptive. I've seen many people sent back to prison because they proved to be disruptive and violent. It's all right to be disruptive and violent in prison, it seems, but not in mental hospitals. I agree to the extent that I think what your question is raising, Kimmett, is that in all of those institutions where people may be held against their will, you need the utmost vigilance to protect their human rights. To the extent that it's not happening in mental hospitals doesn't to me mean that we should use our prisons as mental hospitals. It means we should improve our mental hospitals. It certainly doesn't mean we should reconfigure those huge asylums that were closed down so long ago, and which were in many cases dreadful places. But it does mean that we should not be replacing the absence of proper care in the community, the absence of proper mental health institutions by care in custody. It's not what prisons are for, and it's not what they can do. They cannot do it effectively. So I think to both of those questions, we need a place to which people can be sent from court and who can be held there, who can be held there and looked after there, whatever their condition or treatability, if they need a secure environment at all. The answer to your question, Connor, is yes to all of the above, I think. It's quite clear that two things have been happening. One is, as all the academic work, the work that Mike Huff has done recently shows, is that we are sentencing more people to prison for the same offences as we did 5 or 10 years ago. And when we're sending them to prison, we're sending them to prison for longer. So there are two drivers to the prison population. One is the sheer number of people sent there, but the other, and increasingly that's the case, is the length of sentences that people are being sent to prison for. It's the kind of prison equivalent of bed blocking. People aren't coming out as often as they did. And therefore, that's one of the reasons why whatever happens now to decisions and sentencing, overcrowding in prisons will take a long, long time to work out of the system, because it is a function of the people who are already there, who make up the great number of the prison population is made up of people who are there for a long time, although the great number of people entering prison enter it for a short time. So that's one driver, and it is a consequence of the way that we have dealt with crime publicly. It's a combination of what politicians have wanted, what the media has said, what courts have provided. Magistrates' Court, for example, sentence to prison now much, much more often than ever they used to. But I think it is also partly, the second reason, is because we lack viable alternatives very often. when you talk to magistrates about sentencing, what I very rarely get is the feeling of people red in tooth and claw who simply want to hang them and flog them and send them to prison and lock away the key. What I get the sense of desperation of what on earth are they to do with the person who has appeared before them many times, who has serious, probably drug or alcohol problems, or indeed mental illness, who is not going to report back for bail, who is not going to be able to carry out community service, partly because they've failed in it before, partly because they're quite blatantly not going to be able to get up at 9 o'clock in the morning and dig out the local park or whatever they're required to do. And we do not have available sentences enough of those intermediate options which are needed sometimes to build structure into the unstructured lives of many of those who come before the courts. The absence of the ability to do that is one of the things that sometimes drives sentences in desperation to use prison. And we're using it, as I said in my talk, we are using it as our too difficult train. We're using it as the place you send people that you don't know what else to do with.
Thank you. Next, take you first, and then, sir. Yes, yes.
Human rights, which is just basically philosophical. I know what's going on with the reports because everybody knows about the reports. We've got a question regarding the way you do your inspections. I mean, England has got her own kind of inspections, and for example, in Europe, we've got the Committee Against for the Prevention of Torture. So, what I would like your comment on the kind of idea that I have. For example, what if, I mean, in order for the inspections to have a result, I mean, to have something that we can touch and see that something happens. What if, for example, there is a convergence of your standards with the standards that the committee uses? Because everybody's got its own standards. UN has its own standards, plus the usual criticism that there are regarding their own system. I mean, England's got its own standards, Europe's got its own standards. So people don't know what's happening. They don't know what their standards, the human rights standards, should be in jails. Because you mentioned compliance. Either the governors are powerless to do something about it because they don't have the resources, or they don't know if it's wrong or it's not. I mean, what if, for example, there is a convergence of standards? And not only this, but there's also education, because if you don't educate the staff or the governors, they don't know what's happening. So what can they do about it? And I would also say, I mean, repercussions, at the end of the day, inspections are good. We go into the jails, we see what's happening. But what will happen at the end of the day? I mean, you name and shame with your with the reports that they come out. But what's happening afterwards? I mean, what about legal repercussions? Because the courts in England, I mean, you have the Human Rights Act, but there is still the margin of appreciation. And although the courts are a bit better, let's say, nowadays in interfering in prison life, they're still very, very reluctant to do it.
The two questions there, I think, on human rights standards and repercussions after the publication of the reports, etc. So I said to you were next. If you can just wait for a moment for the mic, because then you can be heard by others.
Tom Bloom, Amnesty International. Have you had access to Belmarsh Prison, where the untried prisoners are kept? What were your findings, and how big can your influence be to improve the situation?
Very straight and simple. I think we've got three questions at least, if not four, and you're by your count.
I detected three questions in what you were asking. One was about convergence of our standards and the Committee for the Prevention of Torture. The other was about training, and the other was about what happens next. Our standards, as I said, our criteria derive from exactly the same international standards that the Committee for the Prevention of Torture and the UN protocol and so on are operating from. As you very well know, the standards that are set out in UN documents and so on are pretty vague. What we try to do in our expectation is to bring them down to boringly detailed actualities. What, you know, has the prisoner been given a phone call, a shower when they arrive in the prison? Have they, you know, what's happening in terms of segregation? who's monitoring the use of the special cells, who's monitoring what. So we kind of use those very broad statements and we bring them down to the kind of detail that means that we can feel in touch and see what's happening. So I don't think there's an issue about lots of different double standards and so on. I think what we're doing is importing into a domestic mechanism precisely those principles and trying to give them life. Training, I absolutely agree with you. One of the scandals about our prisons, I mean, as I said, there are many good people working in them. But those people now get 6 weeks basic training in order to look after people in prisons, some of them children, some of them disturbed, etc. If you want to be a probation officer, you have to train for 2 years. If you want to be a prison officer, you train for 6 weeks. And the only mandatory training now for prison officers after their 6 weeks basic training is training in control and restraint. There is no other mandatory training for prison officers. So it's a key issue. You're absolutely right to point to it. What happens next is very important to us. We publish reports, and as you say, some of them name and shame. Actually, the great majority of them are fairly praiseworthy and don't ever get into the press, but no one ever notices those. But all of our reports will have many, often up to 100, recommendations of things that the prison needs to do. And what will happen next is that the prison and the prison service will draw up an action plan in order to meet those recommendations. They don't have to accept them, but they accept the great majority of them, in fact, and they will then produce an action plan about what they're going to do. What we do next is that without any warning, about 18 months, 2.5 years later, we go back without telling them and we check whether the action plan has actually been put into action or whether it's sitting in somebody's drawer gathering dust. So we do, I mean, it's very important for us that what we say has an effect, that it isn't just a document that sits there and gets looked at. So that's as near as I can get to your questions. The answer about Belmarsh, yes, we can, and we did go into Belmarsh in the course of a prison inspection, but while the detainees were there. One of the things, and it's true, and it relates to the first question about immigration detention too. One of the limits of my remit is that I can only report on the conditions and the treatment of those who are held in detention. I can't report on or directly question whether they ought to be there in the first place. And if I start straying into that territory, then there will be difficulties because I will be outside my remit and first of all, no one needs to listen. But secondly, I think it's very important when you have got a very specific human rights remit that you stick with it. So the only thing in Belmarsh as elsewhere we could do was to look at the conditions and treatment of those detainees and to talk to them through interpreters and find out what was going on. A couple of interesting things emerged, a couple of things that we mentioned in the report emerged. The first was that they were being offered the possibility of going to a different prison, to Wood Hill, and they didn't want to go there. And the reason they didn't want to go there was because they weren't all the same. They weren't all a sort of homogenous group of people. They were actually a different group of people, and they, in fact, preferred to be in the prison they were at the time. But the second, much more disturbing thing, really, was that Belmarsh prison as a whole was not running very well, was not running at all well. Many of the prisons in Belmarsh were spending an inordinate amount of time locked behind their doors. They were not getting out regularly. They were not getting association regularly. They were not getting enough activities. That was the case for all the prisoners in Belmarsh. The detainees were no worse off than other prisoners, but then they ought to have been considerably better off because they had not been charged with or convicted of any crime.
Thank you. There's several hands. I'll take one in the front and then one in the back. Madam. And then.
Yes, this in a sense leads on from that. I found your talk very, very interesting. I've had a small amount of experience of visiting prisons, visiting people in prisons, just as an ordinary person. And I'd absolutely agree with you that prison staff, from the governors downwards, are by and large as much the victims of the system as the inmates that they're taking care of. However, my main involvement is again with immigration detainees. And I've read many of your reports on various immigration detention centres, immigration removal centres. And what really concerns me there is a sort of, asylum seekers are not popular people. And this is a much more directly political issue, perhaps, than ordinary civilian, I don't know what you call them, ordinary prisoners. Also, most or certainly many immigration centres are run by privately contracted companies. And I do visit detainees, and frankly, I have not been terribly impressed by some of the staff, some of the detention custody officers or senior staff or the companies themselves that I have come across. And for example, they don't seem to be even as well qualified, either theoretically or in practice, as ordinary prison staff to deal with self-harming, suicides, mental health problems that might be present amongst immigration detainees. And there seems to be a sort of a general lack of accountability, or at least not as much accountability, that comes out of your reports. That's no fault of yours, but there doesn't seem to be the same interest in people actually improving conditions once the reports have actually come out, because frankly nobody really seems to care. I would add that I'm also a member of Amnesty International, and that's obviously why I have this great interest in human rights, and I'd be grateful if you could comment on some of those points.
Thank you. There was one at the back, I think, sir.
It was a similar point. It was I was going to ask you what power you have to ensure that your recommendation is implemented, in particular in relation to the detention of children at Oakington. And you said that in 2.5 years' time you might be able to pop in and see if your action plan has been taken up. I wonder if there's anything else that you have the power to do within your remit to ensure that these recommendations are being implemented, especially with detention of children at Oakington and the planned expansion of the Alswood for families as well.
And the last one before in this group.
I do a lot of community work in Brent with the local groups. The Rehabilitation of Offenders Act. These people come out of prison, they look for jobs, they tick a box that discloses I have a prison record, the employer is suspicious, rejects them, they don't tick the box, they get checked, they're still unemployed, they do drink and drugs, it goes on and on. They go back to prison. This act, what about their human rights?
Yes, immigration removal centres first. I agree with all you say about the unpopularity of asylum seekers, and also the way in which there is in some ways less concern for them. And of course there's less concern also because once you take a system, once you take detention out of the eye of the courts, it means that no one has to pay quite so much detailed attention to what actually happens. Or where people are, or whatever. I mean, I don't know whether you looked at our recent report on Campsfield, when we talked about the journeys in transit that detainees had, where, five who'd been in transit for over 18 hours, one had been in transit for 36 hours. People get lost in a hole, and that happens, certainly. I'm not sure about your distinction between privately run centres with detention custody officers and prisons. Certainly the worst of the immigration removal centres that I've inspected were Lindholm Prison. Lindholm was worse by quite a considerable distance, and Hasler not very good. Whereas Oakington, by and large, relationships between staff and prisoners were very good. So I think it's a complex area. But I absolutely agree with you in that I think that the immigration removal centres are now all facing different problems from the ones that they were accustomed to. They are dealing now with more vulnerable, risky people who are more likely to harm themselves or take their own lives, or indeed create disturbances and so on, because they're now dealing with people who imminently may be being removed. And I agree with you that in two of the last centres we've inspected, we were by no means convinced that staff had the skills that they needed to manage this, people, or managing them well, other than by putting them into segregation, which is not an acceptable way of dealing with it. So I agree with your points. I think that all that we're, I mean, one of the things we can offer in that situation is the ability to go in ourselves and find out what's going on and report on it. And it's what we do. In terms of the other question about IRCs and going back, there are two things about the detention of children. I mean, one is that in relation to the children's detention, we have gone further than we normally do in relation to our remit. I said before that we can't really comment on whether people ought to be in detention at all. But when you're looking at children and the rights of children, different things come into play in that. And we have said, and we've said very forcibly, that we believe the current policies in relation to detaining children are wrong, and that the children's welfare cannot be guaranteed in those circumstances. The fact that safeguards, even the minimum safeguards that did exist, weren't happening, something we raised and something we'll follow up with the Immigration Department itself. And although I say that we go back sort of 1.5, 2.5 years, we go back dependent upon a risk assessment of what's actually happening, so that if there is something we're particularly concerned about or an establishment we're particularly concerned about, we'll go in sooner and we'll check things sooner. If there are things that simply shouldn't just lie on the table for longer, and we will keep on pressing for things to change, which is more than we can do. But you're right. But you're right. I mean, it was interesting that the experience for my staff in inspecting immigration removal centres was quite interesting. These were people who were accustomed to inspecting prisons, and were really shocked and horrified by what they found in immigration removal centres. Not because they were absolutely dreadful places, but simply because of the sheer scale of distress of people there, and the fact that it was under the radar of most organisations and systems. It simply wasn't being noticed. And it was also interesting that when we first did our first round of inspections, the Immigration Department was not used to being inspected, unlike the prison service. And when we always send drafts of our reports for comment to the service in case there are any factual inaccuracies, and that's precisely what we mean, is have we got it wrong? Are there not 150 but 130 people in this place? You know, have we got any of our facts wrong? The Immigration Department seemed to think that was a process by which they could challenge our findings or suggest that we made different recommendations, but we told them that actually wasn't the way the game was played. and this is, as I say, a function of something that wasn't used to being inspected, that was used to being able to operate entirely out of the view of courts and the general public. You mentioned rehabilitation of offenders, and it's very important. The other lecture I could have given and didn't was the one about what we do for people in prison. We give them, sometimes for the first time, education and qualifications. In many places, we give them skills. And I mean, what I wasn't talking about, so I was talking about human rights in prison specifically, was some of the excellent skills training and so on that goes on in some of our prisons. As I said, prejudiced by the amount of overcrowding, but nevertheless, it's happening, and people are coming out with qualifications, coming out with skills. What happens to them then is that they fall down a hole. Nobody wants to know. That having had a prison, you know, you may come out with a bit of laminated paper, but you also come out with a criminal record. And the huge difficulties then in people gaining employment. And one of the things that we're trying to do in terms of our resettlement work is to encourage the prison service, and it's doing so more and more, to make links with local employers, to try to get public authorities to take people on. Because you're absolutely right, unless people get employment, a home and employment are the two key things that will stop someone reoffending. And if they get neither, the chances of them ending up back in prison are very high.
Fine. Thank you very much. Before taking the last group of questions, I would, as chair, like to take advantage of just making a general comment. One of the great successes of the evening is really to point us in the direction of how we all can behave as specialists within areas of great concern, but how we have to seek ways, better ways, of linking our knowledge and our recommendations with what is going on in neighbouring areas of responsibility. Anna, as was very clear about the limits to her remit, it's almost like saying we all have a job description, and too often we neglect the business as publicists of actually noticing when we have a specialist model sitting here of what might be more effectively done in other areas of activity and professional work. Obviously, the immediate implication is to do with training and prison staff, and to do with lawyers, to do with magistrates in particular, about those issues which impinge on the problem which Anne has been describing. So it's a very clear reminder that it's very difficult to make significant progress in one really anxious area of human activity unless we make more general progress as well. And that's like saying, in relation to this discussion, that, you know, to establish better acknowledgement of human rights, we don't just have to work within prisons. We've got to work among prison warders. We've got to work among doctors. We've got to work among hospitals. I mean, I felt very strongly in what I've heard so far that part of the problem that Anne is facing in getting good information, and an inspector has enormous powers in some senses, but they're trying to catch up on information about total institutions or non-households. And I'm familiar in many other walks of my work in international and national social policy that we lack routinely information about some of the most vulnerable people in nursing homes, in residential care, in all sorts of places like that, and also hospital. I couldn't help reflecting that if only we had more routinized information, there would be a lot better in life. Many people present will be familiar that our information about health is really not telling as much in the surveys that are carried out about people who actually live in prison, in hospital, in nursing homes and residential homes. And this is a most significant element of ignorance about general accounts of the health of a population. And Anne would benefit, and we would be able to pinpoint her work more effectively if there were automatically collected information about prisoners right through the system, and which was, it often is collected, of course, to the extent that we would all value, but it isn't available, but either for reminding people of the extent of mentally vulnerable people who may be replacing some of those asylums we've closed in an indirect sense. And that is a very good reminder, too, of the way in which we have to behave both as specialists and generalists, of trying to find better ways of having alliances with other organizations, other professions, whose success we depend on for success in our own area. I'm sorry to pontificate a bit like that, but it does allow me to say we've got five more minutes and we can have a group of three questions. You were asking before. Second? Sir, you're a new questioner. Oh, I see. We've got one there already. You can be third. Could you speak to the mic rather than to your hand? Not working?
Here's one.
Another one.
Hello.
Better luck.
I'm doing a project on the conditions in women's prisons in particular. You mentioned the suicide rate is higher than women's prisons and men, when that's not the case in society. I was just wondering, in your opinion, what are the characteristics of women's prisons, or women in particular, or the features that mean this is the case?
Last one, sir.
I was curious if you could expand on some of the distinctions that you found between the private prisons and the public prisons. Yeah, just in general.
Thank you.
Some big ones to end with. Families, extremely important. We have a whole set of expectations on families, friends, visits, all of those kind of things. When the prison service itself says is its aim that prisoners should be held no more than 50 miles away from home, that is nowhere near being met, and even if it were, it would still be quite a long way. It's particularly not met for women, because there are fewer women's prisons, and therefore, and they're also young offenders, so there are fewer of them, and therefore they're likely to be even further away from home. But also things like when prisons have visits, do they have evening visits, for example? Or do they have family visits, as one women's prison did, at 9 o'clock in the morning? When families are having to travel 150 miles maybe to get to the prison, it's things like that. We're looking at particularly women's prisons for family liaison officers, who can work with the family as well as with the woman, because there may be children in care, there may be all kinds of issues that need to be dealt with. So there's a whole raft of things where prisons haven't been traditionally very good at providing facilities for visitors. Even basic things like being able to get through on the visits booking line. I mean, you need to spend a day and a half sometimes to even get an answer on some of the booking lines. So all of those things are things that we look at and inspect and we'll make recommendations about if they're not there. But it's far from ideal. But we do consider it a very important part of prison life, which leads on in a way to women. I mean, one of the things that makes women more vulnerable in prison is that over half of them are primary carers of children under 16. And they are extraordinarily concerned about their families when they're in prison, and they run a great risk of losing their children while they're in prison. Two things that happen to women in prison. One is that women have a greater degree of imported vulnerability than men do. A much greater proportion of them have had mental illness, indeed have had psychiatric treatment before entering prison. A greater proportion of them are using a variety of substances. A greater proportion of them have suffered abuse of various kinds, physical abuse, sexual abuse, and so on. So they're bringing in with them a whole lot of vulnerabilities. But they are also people for whom prison measurably increases the vulnerability. Women in our surveys, much higher proportion report problems on arrival, major problems on arrival that need dealing with, usually around families. The experience of imprisonment for women has a different kind of effect than the experience of imprisonment for men, because of the absence of sort of socialization and so on. And if they have got support networks outside, they're much less likely than men to keep them. 60% of women in prison who've got partners lose their partner while they're in prison. A third of them lose their homes. A story that was told me once by a man who governed men's prisons and was governing a women's prison about the great difference he noticed that when he released men from his men's prison, there was a kind of welcome party waiting at the gate usually, with a car and perhaps a bottle of champagne or something. When he released women, there was almost always no one there, and the woman walked alone from the prison. So those are some of the reasons. The vulnerability women bring with them, and the increased vulnerability that incarceration provides. And that means we have to look at why we imprison women, where we imprison them, and what kinds of imprisonment may be necessary when it is necessary. The last question was about private and public prisons. Very interesting question. In this country, I think we have been very lucky in our private prisons. Private prisons raise all kinds of human rights issues around whether it is ever right to allow the responsibility of the state for incarceration to be handed over to a private company to do it for profit. Those are ethical and human rights considerations always. We have been lucky in our private prisons for this reason, that almost all of our private prisons have been run by people who were running public sector prisons and who were able in the private sector to run the prisons they wished they'd been able to run in the public sector but couldn't. Because at that time, the inflexibility of staff, the POA, the inflexibility of the regimes in prison, and the buildings in which they were huge drags on any reform. And it is true that we used private sector prisons to pull up the standard in our public sector, in our public sector prisons, and it did happen. I have more concern now, because if we are now opening up to greater amounts of contestability, if we're looking, and I've heard some people say that we may be looking to have a third of our prisons privately run, then we are going to be pulling in the net into the net other kinds of providers for whom the bottom line may be the only line. And I think this is something that needs very, very carefully to be watched. As you well know, it's not always the case that private sector prisons are good prisons. They're not good prisons. Many of them aren't good prisons in the States. There's no reason of itself why they should be here except for the way that they were set up and the way that they were run. They tend to be prisons at the moment here where relationships between staff and prisons are better, but where sometimes safety is more fragile because they pay less than the public sector, they employ less experienced staff, as you were saying about immigration removal centres, and they keep staff for less long. So you've often got some inexperienced staff and some highly experienced prisoners. But by and large, they have provided a way of driving up performance and try and persuading the public sector to drive up its performance. But that needn't necessarily always be the case.
Could I close the meeting by thanking Anne Owers? We afterwards, as I promised, the source of the refreshments, the reception will be in the atrium, which is on this floor and therefore reasonably handy rather than climbing up the lifts. But I think we've been treated to a kind of model lecture about a problem in human rights which is rumbling on and which is going to attract more and more attention. And I feel that this audience, by being extraordinarily attentive and having so many questions thrown up and answered so effectively by Anne, we are very grateful to her for the stamina she has demonstrated and the sharp perception and the down-to-earth quality which is immediately useful in entering prisons, of not carrying any brusque authority in a way which will deter people from both listening and finding in Anne someone who with whom they can communicate exactly. I think we've been privileged this evening, and I want on your behalf to thank Anne very much.